Today we have Dan G, who I was introduced by Mary Susan Nana, and just one of those people you just are fortunate enough to meet thanks to the pandemic. Lovely, lovely guy, 50 plus years of sobriety, just one of those people that just like a few of you right now I see in the room, just make you want to come back, be it a secular meeting, a traditional meeting, or any type of meeting. Always enjoy hearing them. And yeah, thank you, Dan. Take as long as you need, sir. Dan G, everybody.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. It's a good thing, zooming across the ocean to the homeland of my ancestors, if you will. I'm partially a Cork man, so don't hold that against me. My name is Dan. I am an alcoholic. I'm really happy to be here today sober. I'm happy to be anywhere alive and sober. And that was brought home to me very vividly a little over 5 months ago when I went into the local hospital here. And what was supposed to happen, they suspected I had a blockage in my heart, and they were going to put a stent in. And they ran the catheter in with the little camera and took a look around. And when I come out of the anesthesia, my cardiologist was there. He said, by the way, you're not going home. We've got a room for you upstairs in the hospital, and we're going to wait for a room to open at Mass General Hospital. You need a lot of work done on your heart. 3 days later, I was in Mass General in Boston, and I had triple bypass surgery, and I had one of my aortic valves replaced while they were in there tinkering around. So I was a very sick puppy for a few weeks. There were times when I thought, you know how you hear people that have near-death experiences? They talk about seeing a bright light, a bright white light. And I was seeing that, but I was hallucinating fiercely, fiercely. I was seeing all kinds of colors. I was seeing just rows and rows of the same truck. It was just, I can't even explain it. But it was horrible. It was horrible. And sometime after all that started, when I was coming out of it, I heard my wife's voice, and I knew then that I was going to be okay, that I was alive. I thought I was dead. I thought I was gone. And it was relatively close, I think, at times. I know I was on the operating table for, I don't know, something like 8 hours. They had to take me in later on because I had some bleeding going on. They had to open me up again and do a little more work. It was a really tough go. Once I get over the anesthesia, I was able to put it kind of where it belongs. It became another day, a day at a time, and I just had to go through each day, each moment, and be grateful that I was alive. Be happy that I had my wife there beside me. Excuse me. I don't talk that much of late because, well, like today, my wife's out. My son, daughter-in-law, and granddaughter are all at work. I'm living with them temporarily. They've helped with the rehab and so forth, and it's been wonderful. My voice gets real scratchy. So I have a cough drop in. So hopefully that'll help me to maintain, so you'll be able to understand, even through my Boston accent. Although I don't think I have an accent. I think you people from Ireland have a bit of an accent, but that's okay. Love you dearly. So anyway, as I said, I'm an alcoholic. I was born in Salem, Massachusetts. I was brought up there in Salem. Some of you may have heard of Salem as the witch city, but that's where I was born and brought up. And I lived there until I went into the service at 18 years old. I came from a good family. It was a good house to grow up in. I was number 5 of 6 boys. It was a bit of a crazy house at times, but it was a lot of fun. And it was good to have a lot of brothers around. Believe me, I could walk through the neighborhood and never have to fear anybody giving me any crap, because 4 older brothers were always willing to help take care of me if needed. And it was just really nice. It was a nice, comfortable, working class neighborhood. My parents were both hardworking folk. My father worked for the local phone company for some, like 40 years before he retired. My mother, most of the time, at least in my early years, she was home. She did finally go outside the house to work, probably when I got into like the 8th grade or something. I'm not sure. It doesn't matter. Anyhow, what I'm getting at, it was a good neighborhood. I mentioned that I spoke at a noontime meeting, so I get like sick of hearing myself after a while, but that's okay. This is different people here today, although many of the people on this meeting have heard me more than once. So, but they'll understand. The little section of street that I lived, there were 5 houses, and 3 were occupied by my family and 2 others by relatives of mine. And around the corner was my grandmother and some more cousins, and take the corner the other way was another aunt and uncle and cousin. It was really a great, comfortable place to grow up. I had what I needed. We didn't have a lot. My father worked real hard to make sure we had what we needed, which was good food, clean clothes, opportunity to go to school if we chose to. I'll tell you more about that later. Anyway, I probably picked up my first drink somewhere in the 14, 15 year old. I'm not exactly sure. Might have been 16. It doesn't matter. I don't remember my first drink. What I do always want to remember is my last drunk. That's what's really important for me to remember in my sobriety. The first time I had enough alcohol to either be drunk or pretend that I was drunk, and I'm not sure to this day which it was, a group of us guys that hung out together on New Year's Eve, one of the guy's parents were going out for the night, and he had the run of the house. So he had us, 5 or 6 of us come over. We got someone to buy us some alcohol, and we drank at his house for New Year's. And I know part of the night I spent in a bathtub. Thankfully, there was no water in it, so I didn't drown, obviously. And I fell into it. I had been going to the bathroom, and when I was done, I kind of backed up and stumbled into the tub and sat down in it. And I stayed there for a while, I think partially because I couldn't get out. I don't know if somebody came in and helped me out or not. It doesn't matter. And I remember another part of that night. I spent curled up in front of the front door of the apartment, and then people couldn't get in or out. And I thought that was a good idea. I was like the doorkeeper, if you will. That was my introduction to drinking about as much as I could at that point in time. Excuse me. The next time I had... Excuse me 1 minute. There we go. The next time I had enough alcohol to drink with restrictions off were when I was 18 years old, I went active duty in the U.S. Navy. And I went out to boot camp at Great Lakes, Illinois. And we were there over the Christmas holiday. And they gave us 2 weeks leave to go home for Christmas, which was great. and a whole group of us from the Boston area. We had our tickets arranged, and we got a train from Chicago to Boston. And part of that trip, once you got out of Illinois, they could open the club car. I don't know what those restrictions were. Doesn't matter. But we had gotten street people, alcoholics more than likely like us, to buy us alcohol before we got on the train. Because in Chicago at that time, if you had an ID that said you were a Navy recruit, no matter how old you were, you could not buy alcohol in Chicago. I guess it was a deal they had with the Navy. Anyway, we had some alcohol. We drank it while we were chugging our way out of Illinois. Indiana came. They opened the club car. It was a couple of days before Christmas. We were all in our dress uniforms, looking pretty sharp for a while. We found our way to the club car, and there were a bunch of civilians in there. Everybody was in the holiday mood. They were buying us Navy guys drinks, and I was drinking all I could get my hands on, and I got wiped out. I got legless. I couldn't get back to my car where my seat was. My nana's sending me messages to take my time and drink some water. I got it right next to me here. Anyway, one of the guys I was traveling with decided he was going to try to help me back to my seat. And we got to the first door of the club car, and evidently I was so wiped out, I was so drunk. When we got there, he stopped, and my head went backwards like this, and I hit him right in the nose. And he spent his 2 weeks at home with a couple of black eyes. When I first got sober, in order to sound like a real tough guy, I used to say that I whacked him as if I punched him. I didn't punch him. I was drunk as a skunk, and I couldn't keep my head stable, and I belted him with my head. So that's how that went. Got home. It was like a 20-hour train trip, 24-hour. I don't remember how long. Got to Boston. I got a bus from Boston to Salem. I was dating a woman, a girl who was, I was 18. She was 16 or 17, still in high school. And I went up to the high school because she hadn't got out of school yet, and I wanted to see her. And I showed up with, I'm sure I had puke spattered shoes. My white hat was probably dingy gray at that point. I had messed up. We had these nice silk ties that we would not really look sharp. That was spotted. I found that out later. And I'm sure I smelled like a drunk who had been on a 24 puking drunk. And I don't think she was really pleased to see me at school that day. In fact, it wasn't long after that we were no longer a couple. I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but I think she was smart enough to dump me, whatever the reason. Anyhow, these should have been signposts, but it didn't mean anything to me. It really didn't. I just figured would probably have to learn how to drink properly. And if you're an alcoholic, like I was an alcoholic, you don't learn how to drink. It was, I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I didn't know I had the disease of alcoholism. I didn't know that. And I believe I had it at that time. I don't know if I was born with this. I don't know if I picked it up off a toilet seat. I don't know if it's genetic. I tend to believe it's genetic. Because I've heard it said around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it certainly applies to my family. If you shake my family tree, a whole lot of empties will fall out. And although I didn't have people in AA in my family, except for one uncle did put together a little bit of time in AA, but he could not keep it together. And he was, he and one of my other uncles were like the family drunks, and they lived in rooming houses in Salem. And, you know, they had the typical drunky story. And Uncle Ed and Uncle Joe. Anyhow, I went back to boot camp. I made myself a promise that I would control myself. I had a wicked temper as a kid. I didn't want to get in a lot of trouble. I was signed up to do 2 years active duty, and I wanted to get my 2 years done and get out of the Navy and get back home. And that's what I did. I was able to keep my hot-temperedness down most of the time. And I got through it without any problems. I did most of my drinking when I would get home for long weekends or so forth. And then I had my brothers to help me get out of any jams I might have got into or what have you. Anyhow, I did get out of the service. I went to work at a local retail store in Peabody, Massachusetts. And it was over a, I got home towards the end of October. I probably started the first part of November. It was a Christmas holiday job. I was working as a stock clerk in this retail store. And me and a couple of other guys figured out that if we punched out at noontime and we ran, we could get over to the cocktail lounge and we could fire down several beers and get back to work almost on time most of the time. Needless to say, I did not get kept on that job once the couple of months was over and Christmas was gone by. Then I collected unemployment for about 7 months. I bought a little motor scooter. It's a wonder I didn't get killed on that thing, because I would drive around North Shore in varying stages of drunkenness. It was a little Vespa motor scooter and had like a little bubble around the back wheel and little compartments, and you could put two or three beers in each one. And it was cool enough that it would keep cool, or I could even throw some ice in there and it would stay as long as it would. And I could ride along and drink a beer. And it was silliness. It was silliness more than anything else. I didn't get into trouble. I didn't get a drunk drive. And one of the things that shows where my mind was is that I would, I made myself promise that I would drive out as close to the white line in the center of the road, because they didn't put trees or telephone poles out there. And that was my fear, that I would crash into something, not concerning myself about other vehicles on the road. So that shows you a certain lack of judgment on my part when I drank. During this period of time, I met and fell in love with a lovely young lady. It was in a McDonald's parking lot across the bridge in Beverly, Massachusetts. Very romantic story. Me and a couple of my cousins were out tooling around on our motor scooters. One of my cousins was dating a good friend of the woman that I was meeting for the first time. And when we got there, they were there. She's my wife now, but she wasn't then, obviously, but she was driving her parents' car. And the three of us guys got in the backseat. We had a fun time, you know, cracking jokes, just being fun. I was showing off is what I was doing. And I fell in love with her right from that very first night. Took me a month or so to get up enough courage to ask the friend who she was with, who was actually a mutual friend of mine and a neighbor. She lived across the street from where I was living at that time. And I finally got up the courage to ask her, to ask Elaine, if Elaine would go out with me. And Elaine said yes, and we started dating. We dated for the better part of 2 years. I had to ask her three times to marry me, because the first two times I was, according to her, I was too drunk. She wouldn't answer me. The third time I asked, I must have screwed up enough courage with a minimal amount of alcohol. And she said yes. And that's probably an answer she regretted, over the next few years. But we got married. We We started a family. She was working. I was working. We weren't making a lot of money, but we never had money left over. And I come to realize after I got into AA why that was. I was drinking so much. I was drinking up any cash I could get my hands on. I worked in a factory that made games in Salem, Massachusetts, Parker Brother Games. And me and a couple of other guys used to do some midnight shopping from the cars there. We had a place where we could fence the games, and I would do that in order to have more money for drinking. It was just a terrible, sad existence when I'm looking back on it. But that's what it was for me. I would do whatever it took to drink as much as I could, as long as I could. We started a family. Our son was born, and it was the light of my life. I was just so thrilled to be a father and to have a boy. He was named after me. He was going to be just like me. Thankfully, it hasn't turned out that way. He's a good guy. In fact, as I said earlier, we're actually camped out with he and his wife and their daughter. We're looking forward to, in a couple of weeks, we'll be heading to Florida. I finally got through all my medical stuff that I have to do, and I've got an airline ticket booked for February 2nd, and I'll be able to get the hell out of this winter and get down where it's warm. Anyway, we're here, and my son is just being so wonderful. I mean, anything I need, you know, he's very attentive. It's marvelous, really. And I thank him all the time for all that he and his family are doing for me as I recover from my surgery. Anyhow, Elaine went back to work because we needed more money than I was bringing in. She went back to work and she took time off after our son was born for a year or two. And then she went back to work and at the retail store where she had worked previously. And we just never had enough. I was always borrowing money from my older brothers, trying to pay them back. Oftentimes didn't. I drank with my older brothers as much as I could. Although there was a time where one of my brothers who I thought I was most alike, pulled me aside one day. He said, "Dan, we don't know what's wrong with you, but we just want to go out and have a good time. And whenever we get out and you're drinking, you want to get into a fight. You want to start fights." And that wasn't, you know, that wasn't my personality. But you put a drink in me, that's what my personality became. You know, I just, another of my older brothers told my son once, because my son was two when I stopped drinking. And of course, I'd never had a drink with him. And I think he was talking to one of my older brothers about how he wished that he could have a beer with his father, you know, that kind of stuff. And this older brother said, "Nah, you wouldn't want to drink with him. You know, he would get drinking. And if he decided he was going to fight with you, you might as well just go ahead and fight, because it was going to start it whether you wanted to or not." That was the personality change that I had under the influence of alcohol. And I didn't much care for it, believe me, but it's what was. Anyhow, Elaine went back to work. We were going to a Christmas party for her work. It was on a Sunday night. I worked Saturday night. I had taken a civil service exam, passed, and got a job as a firefighter in my local community, Salem. I was working that job, and I could have lost that job several times during my first year, which is a probationary period, and I would go to work half drunk. Thankfully, I didn't get turned in. I didn't get into trouble with that, but I absolutely could have gotten into a lot of trouble with that. And so we went to this, we were going out to a party on a Sunday night, and I went, I got home from work after working the overnight shift early Sunday morning. I knew we had plans for the day. As I said, I probably said this 2 hours ago in the other meeting, but I hadn't spent a hell of a lot of time with my wife, and certainly I hadn't spent any quality time with her or with our 2-year-old son. And it was eating me up, and I didn't know what was going on. You know, I would set goals for the things that I wanted to do, and I would not be able to accomplish them. And they would be spend time with my wife, spend time with my son, get studying at work for promotion, you know, stop getting into trouble, you know, do the right thing. And I became increasingly convinced that if I couldn't do these things that I wanted to do, that I must be crazy. And I was going to get locked up in the local insane asylum, Denver State Hospital. That didn't happen, obviously. But I found out what happened once I got into AA. But anyhow, I had all these plans for the last day that I drank, at least up until now, and I hope it will be my last drunk. But I had all these plans for that day, and there was the outside chance that some of them could have come true, except I picked up a drink in the morning. I went out to watch a football game. That's American football, not your soccer. Some friends of mine were playing in a championship game at a local high school stadium. And it was a snowy, cold December morning. And I took my, whatever I had left in a pint of whiskey, some beer, off we went. And, I was drunk before the halftime of that game. I don't remember the outcome of the game. I don't remember the end of it. Doesn't matter. I spent the rest of the afternoon in a local club. It's called the Russian Society Club in Salem. And, you know, I remember all of that day. And I hope I never forget it. I didn't go into a blackout that day. And I had blackouts. One of my worst blackouts, I went to work on the fire department. I went to work drunk. And when I got there, I slid into a blackout and I performed my job that evening. We didn't have big fires, but we had 3 separate small incidents that we went to. I went, I functioned, I did my job. I have no recollection of any of that, none whatsoever. The next morning when the guys were talking about it, I had to go down and check the logbook to see that they weren't messing around with me. But they were in the logbook. Engine one responded, responder responded. And I have no clue what I did. I must have done what I had to do or I'd have been in trouble. And that's a scary situation. Firefighting is a dangerous enough job when you're sober. And when you do it drunk, there's certainly something wrong. And it scared the crap out of me for a couple of hours until I got the first drink of the next day. And then it became, oh, what the hell? No big deal. Everybody does that. No, not everybody. There were guys who would show up drunk on the fire department and they would be covered for. But you know what? It wasn't everybody. It wasn't a majority. It was a few. And I was one of them. And it wasn't a good thing. Anyhow, I did remember that I had to take my wife out to a Christmas party on this Sunday night. I got home to get ready to go. Elaine had decided she didn't think it was a good idea for us to go. Excuse me a minute. And I convinced her that we should go. And we did go. And it was not good. We went to a cocktail party at my in-laws' house, and it was my in-laws, my wife and I, and another couple, and somehow I knew the woman of that couple was a recent divorcee, so that made her a fair game for me, and I tried to put a move on her, and it was disgusting, and it was right there in my mother-in-law's living room on my mother-in-law's couch with my mother-in-law sitting on the other side of this woman. So I like to say that emphasizes my poor judgment when I drank. I didn't have really good judgment when I was sober, but when I drank, it was off the charts bad. Anyhow, off we went to the party. Everything about that night was bad. I hated the place. I hated the meal. I hated the band. I hated the people we were sitting with. I couldn't stand anything about it. I tried to egg her, my wife's boss, into an argument so I could fight with him. Just stupid stuff. He had a speech impediment, and I was making fun of him. That's the kind of guy I was when I drank. I didn't like it, but that's who I was when I drank. Finally, I broke away from the group, and I went to the bar, and I spent most of my time at the bar drinking, and my wife spent most of the rest of the evening wherever I wasn't. Sometime late that evening, I don't know what time, I speculate it was 10, 10:30, doesn't matter. I went into a sitting room off the bar. There was a couch and a fireplace with a fire going. I sat on the couch, and I remember, and this only came to me just a couple of years ago, I remember taking my drink in my hand and putting it down on the floor next to the couch. And I passed out is what happened. Now, if I remove my hat, you people see that I am what my granddaughter has called follically challenged. And I've been follically challenged or bald since I was 23. And back then, it mattered that I was bald. Now I don't care. But back then it mattered. And I went out and I bought a wig for like $19.95 at a local retail store. And I would wear that around wherever I went when I wasn't wearing a hat. I had the wig on. And it kind of matched what hair I had left. It was a kind of a strawberry blonde. It kind of matched the sideburns I had. If I let my beard grow out a little bit, it was kind of reddish blonde. So it wasn't a bad match. It had sideburns. It had bangs. It was kind of, you know, it was the 1960s. And it was styled for the 1960s. And I fit right in. I would go to the bar room with my wig on. And I would pass it around to guys so they could see what they would look like with a nice head of hair like I had. It was silliness. It was silliness. Anyway, when I passed out on the couch, the wig took a quarter turn on my head. I had sideburns down over my nose. I was a mess. They woke me up to take me home. My guess is, and I don't know, whatever I drank out of that last drink that was on the floor, that was my last drink. I got in the car. I had been out for probably an hour and a half, 2 hours. I had sobered up just enough that I knew I was in trouble. Thankfully, my father-in-law was driving us back to Peabody, where we had left our car. And knowing I was in trouble, the words of a friend of mine that I work with on the fire department, his name was Jack Murphy, and he was sober about a year and a half in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was talking to some of the guys around the lunch table, and he made a statement that when he picked up a drink of alcohol, his life became unmanageable and he didn't want to live that way anymore. And that's why he went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I took those words and I stored them away for future use. And it was, I don't know, 6 or 8 weeks after that, that my last drunk occurred. And when I came to, Jack's words came to mind. And I decided, because I knew I was in trouble for my behavior, that I would make the grandstand play and announce I was going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. My mother-in-law, she was something else. And she turned around and she looked me straight in the face and she said, "Dan, those self-help groups have done a lot of good for a lot of people, and perhaps you ought to go." And that's what it was. My mouth got me in trouble again. It took me the better part of a month to go to the only other person I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was able to recognize my plea for help for what it was. And he extended the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And I was just clear enough to be able to accept that. He offered to take me to a meeting that night, and I agreed. He and his sponsor came to pick me up. They picked me up. All the meetings back then were an hour and a half. They were usually 8:30 to 10 at night. There were smoking meetings just about exclusively. And off we went to the meeting. My friend Billy, who I went to talk to Elaine about what was going to go on. And then his sponsor, Roger, talked to me about it. And he made some suggestions, you know, try to listen, try to identify, try not to compare your what you may have done with what others may have done. It really doesn't matter. Try to identify with the feelings they'll be talking about. You know, if you're nervous, sit on your hands. Don't worry about it. Everybody's nervous when they get to a meeting. He said, if you, He said, you should take a long time to decide whether you're an alcoholic or not, because it might be the most important decision you'll ever make in your life. And I believe it's right at the top of my list. I went to that meeting. I heard about the disease of alcoholism, and I'm pretty sure I would have heard about the physical component of this disease. And for me, the physical part of the disease means that when I put a drink of alcohol into my body, it sets up a phenomenon of craving. And I will drink more. It happened over and over and over again. I did not have to have that laid out to me in great detail. I knew what they were talking about because I had lived it. I heard about mental obsession, the fact that no matter what went on when I was drinking, I could always convince myself the next time it would be different. That's what it meant to me. And I would always look forward to that next time, whether it be tonight, the night after, whenever. Planning what I was going to do Friday night with my brothers to go out drinking, always focusing on the alcohol, never on not drinking, always on drinking. And I learned that those two components, the physical and the mental, when coupled together, cause a loss or lessening of one's own values, your code of conduct, your spirituality, whatever you choose to call it. And I understood that. As I said, I came from a good home. I learned a lot of good values from my mother and father. I did, you know, I listened in school. I knew what was right and wrong. Even back then, although I was forced to go, I went to church, and I might have even picked up something good there. I'm not sure. It doesn't matter. But no matter what I thought was good or right, I would set those aside in order to drink more. That's the loss of values that I had. And that's the physical, mental, and spiritual parts of this disease of alcoholism. Excuse me again. I also learned that it was a progressive illness. You know, that what I know about it now and what I truly believe, that although I've been off of alcohol for a long, long time, if I were to pick up again, I would be at the best right back where I left off. And probably because I'm physically a hell of a lot less strong than I was then, it probably would be much worse. I mean, I'm unsteady enough now just walking around. I use a cane whenever I'm out of the house. But, you know, you put a drink of booze in me, I'm going to be bouncing off walls, falling downstairs. I'm going to get hurt really badly. And that's provided that my mouth doesn't get me in trouble. And wouldn't you know, getting a phone call, it kind of interrupted my train of thought, but I shut it off. Anyhow, I believe this is a progressive disease. It's fatal if left untreated. But the really sad part about it is it probably wouldn't take me out. It probably would take me out pretty quickly now. But most times, you know, a younger person picking up again. They're going to go through hell before they're dead. They're going to end up in institutions, whether it be jail, mental institutions, detox, or what. It's going to be a horrible, horrible journey. And I don't want to make that journey. I want to be living the life I'm living today. Anyway, I learned all that early on in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I first got sober, I went to a lot of meetings. If I wasn't in a firehouse at a night, chances are you would find me in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I built a very good foundation, and it stood me in good stead all this time. And, you know, I did all the things that I was supposed to do. I followed it as much as I could, the way it was laid out to me by the people who brought me around. At one point, I asked Billy, who brought me to my first meeting, if he would be my sponsor. And he said, "Dan, no, I don't think so. But I know someone that I think would be a good match for you." And he introduced me to a fellow by the name of Jack Delaney. Jack's gone now. He's been gone, I don't know, 6 or 7 years now. But Jack was my sponsor for the better part of 46, 47 years. And we had a great relationship. In fact, he used to say, "Dan, you're more my sponsor than I'm yours." But we just had a really good relationship. You know, I could talk to him. He could talk to me. You know, we went out to lunch together. His wife and my wife were friends from Al-Anon. And the four of us went out to dinner several times. It was a really nice relationship. And I miss Jack a lot since he's been gone. He was a great guy, just a wonderful person. Jack had somewhere around 52 or 53 years sober when he passed away. But anyhow, that's, and then I did, you know, I tried to do the steps to the best of my ability. It's kind of funny. One night in my first several months, we were on our way to a meeting or on our way home, and Billy was driving again. Billy used to pick me up and take me to meetings for quite a while until he stopped doing it. But that's beside the point. I said, "Billy, I'm having a problem. Do you think you can help me?" He said, "Sure, Dan. What is it?" I said, I'm having a really hard time with the fourth step." He said, "I have the solution for that." I said, "Oh, great. You do the first, the second, and the third for a long time. And then you worry about the fourth step. Don't let it bug you. Take some time. You're all set. Don't worry about it." So, of course, being a good alcoholic, I put it off for about 3 or 4 years before I tackled the fourth step. But I did finally do it. And I did a fifth step. And kind of amusing to me today, back when I was first sober, a group of guys were running retreats twice a year at a place up in Gloucester, Massachusetts, right on the ocean. And they would get usually a priest who was sober in AA to come to be the retreat master. And that priest would generally talk about the spiritual aspect of the 12 steps of recovery. And it was interesting. It was good. But when I first got to AA, I would describe myself as a drunken agnostic. I didn't know what I believed. I didn't much care for religion at all. The guys that took me around would say things to me like, "Don't worry about it if you don't believe in God. Believe that we do and pray to our God." And I would do that. And I heard "fake it until you make it" for years. And I tried that. Eventually, I came to the conclusion that I'm an atheist. I don't believe in a God as most people would. I don't believe in gods. I don't believe in devils. I don't believe in heaven. I don't believe in hell. I don't believe in Buddha, Allah, whatever name you want to give it. I believe my strength comes from the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where I get my strength. That's for me. But it took me a long time. In fact, before I got to this point, I actually somewhere in the big book or one of the stories or somewhere it says, some of us actually return to the religion of our youth. And we found that to be beneficial. I said, well, I'll give that a try. Maybe I'll be open-minded enough now that it'll mean something. And I went back to church. My wife and I became lectors at our local parish. I would read the readings at the Mass, you know, once a month, once every 6 weeks. I tried it for a period of time. I don't know if it was a year or not. It just didn't feel right to me. It just didn't. And I finally stopped going to church again. It was around that time when the Catholic Church was going through a lot of the really horrible stuff with the priests and children. And it just absolutely disgusted me. And I don't want to get into that. That's an outside issue. But it pushed me further away from religion of any kind. And I had a friend of mine back then who I knew was an atheist, and he had really good sobriety. I admired him. Great guy. We're still good friends today. And I started talking with him about atheism and so forth. And I picked up some books and I did some reading and I did some research. And most of what I read fit me. It was me. I believed it. This was me. I am an atheist. Once I made that decision, it was like a burden was lifted from me. I felt freedom. I felt as if I wasn't lying about it. I wasn't faking it anymore. You know, I was being true to myself. And that's one of the things on some of the medallions we get on it says, to thine own self be true. And I wasn't all those years trying to fake a belief in a higher power. But anyway, over the years, I've had many jobs in AA, from sweeping up and emptying ashtrays and cigarettes, butts from coffee cups, sweeping floors, making coffee. I had a job picking up the donuts for about 5 years at one of my meetings. I've been a secretary. I've been a treasurer. I tried being a GSR twice, and the GSR meetings just drove me away. I couldn't handle the BS. It just made no sense to me. But I did that earlier in my sobriety. And then quite a while later, I said, well, I'll give it a try again. The group needed a GSR, and they were debating the same crap 20 years later. And I said, nah, this is not for me. I'm glad we have people that want to do those jobs. They're very, very important. They're not my cup of tea, if you will. I sponsor very few people. I can do this. I can speak at meetings. I can do a lot of different things. I can do a little bit of one-on-one with people. I'm okay. But I'm this sponsor relationship as sponsee relationships in today's AA are not what I remember when I was getting sober. It's certainly not the way it was with Jack and I. If I had a problem, I'd call Jack. Most of the time, we went to pretty much the same meetings. I'd talk to him about things I needed to at or after a meeting. He didn't walk me through the steps. He encouraged me to do the steps when I could. He said, if you have problems, let me know. I'll try to help you. But there was no, it wasn't hand-holding. And I'm not trying to be critical. People that are in that now are doing very well, and they're sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a wonderful thing. It's not for me. It's not the way I was brought up in AA. It's not what I learned. In fact, I don't know if they still do, they had AWOL programs where they would go through the steps systematically over a year period. And I could never do it because I tried. I signed up a couple of times. But if you missed two meetings in a row, they'd throw you out or something like that. And I was on the fire department, and we worked a rotating schedule. So I was going to miss 2 nights in a row, 2 weeks in a row, several times during that year. It just wasn't going to work out. So I never did complete an AWOL. And you know what? I'm still sober today. Anyhow, I'm pretty much getting towards the end. You people are probably glad to hear that. Excuse me. I know my voice is happy to hear that. But you know what? I love being sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. Last December 14th, I got to celebrate 52 years of continuous sobriety. It's been marvelous. My wife and I, this coming June, will be married 57 years. That's the power of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and her 12-step programs working in her life and mine in mine. I like to tell a little story that kind of illustrates the difference in a couple of different times at the same place. The last place that I drank and was, it was a shameful experience, was a place called the Nahant Country Club. 26, 27, 28 years ago, my son and his now wife were planning their marriage and their reception. And unbeknownst to me, they picked the Nahant Country Club. And that was the first time I was going to be back there. In fact, my sponsor, Jack Delaney, with his sense of humor, he kept on saying, I'm going to call them over there and tell them who you are and what you did, and you're not going to be able to go to your son's reception. I love that man. Anyhow, they had their reception. I was in a tuxedo, all dolled up. I even had a black cowboy hat that I wore. I was into country western dancing at that time, and I wore the hat. My son and daughter-in-law said, sure, you want to wear the hat, that's fine. They did. We went to the church. We left the church. We went to the Nahant Country Club. They brought the wedding party into the little room where I passed out on that cold December day, lo, these many years ago. And that's where they put us all in line, and they called us out. They, so we all parade out. And what a feeling that was, to be there, to be honored as father of the groom, to be wanted, loved, and needed. That's the power of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. When we close our atheist agnostic meetings, we close with the responsibility declaration. I am responsible when anyone anywhere reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, I am responsible. And I had three very, very powerful reminders of that in my sobriety. One, when alcohol was through with my mother, she was able to come to me, and I was able to hook her up with some woman in AA. And she spent her last 25 years of life alcohol free. Sometime after that, when booze was done with one of my older brothers, he came to me. I took him to a meeting. He was still hungover. He didn't like the speakers. He thought it was kind of BS. He said, no, I don't need that. I'm okay. And he left. And I said, fine, whatever, Dick. You do whatever you want. Some months later, after a few incidents, one of which was he couldn't show up to give assistance to my father, who was dying. And we were taking turns spending nights with him so that my younger brother, who was living with them, could have a night off once a week. And Dick couldn't show up for his night. He was drunk. And that was his bottom. He couldn't be there for his father. And he got to Alcoholics Anonymous on his own. And Dick lived, as far as I know, I'm pretty sure I'm right when I say this, he lived the last 42, close to 43 years of his life, alcohol free. He just died last May down he lived in Florida, and I used to visit him. I'm going to miss the visit this year, but he's better off. He had a heart attack. It destroyed his kidneys, and he actually died of kidney failure. But they wanted to put him in a nursing home and put him on dialysis, and he didn't want anything to do with that. And he chose to go home and go on hospice, and he died in a couple of days. Coming up on 4.5 years ago, I got a phone call from my grandson. He said, "Grampy, I'm in trouble. I need help. It's alcohol. I have to stop drinking. It's terrible." I said, "Danny, I'm on my way to New Hampshire right now, but I'll be home tonight and we'll get out to a meeting." He said, "Oh, great." I said, "I'll give you a call when we're on our way back from New Hampshire." And I was on my way with another guy in AA who was going up to have some car repairs. And when on the way back, I called my grandson, Dan. I said, "Danny, we're on our way back. We'll go to a meeting." He said, "Hey, Grampy, I found the meetings at the White Whale." He was bummed enough about what alcohol was doing to him that he found his own meeting that day. And we went out to a meeting that night. And late last November, he celebrated 4 years of continuous sobriety. Now he's 26 years old and he's got 4 years under his belt. Hopefully he'll keep it going. I know he's moved. He left this area. He lived in Worcester for a while. He got a group there and he went to meetings. He now lives in Bridgewater, a different locale in Massachusetts. He's a member of a meeting down there. He does coffee and donuts for them. He's doing it the right way. He goes on commitments with his group. I have great hope and optimism for him that Alcoholics Anonymous and the power of the fellowship will stay very strong in his life, and he'll have a wonderful life such as I've had. I thank you all very much for putting up with my long-winded recitation. It isn't often that I get a chance to go through it all. And believe me, I got more. So don't worry about it. If you need more, I got more. But it's been a wonderful, wonderful 52 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's been a great life. I've got so much because of it. I got promoted on the fire department. I left that. We moved to Arizona. It was a sober decision. It didn't work out. We came back. You know, I've ended up putting together a career in government. I've got a reasonable pension. You know, we live pretty good. It's nice. It's all the power of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and people in meetings like this, as such as I see here. So thank you very much for staying with me. That's it. I'm done.